I had never wanted a magic eraser more than I did at that moment. I was lying on the couch in the living room in our apartment in Northwest Indiana, and I was looking. We had these white walls, and they had black marks all over them. I never knew a white wall could get so dirty, and I found myself wishing I could somehow clean it up. But I also kind of wished that I had a magic eraser that could fix the way that my life was going at that moment. Earlier that morning, I got a text from my boss asking if we could meet that afternoon, and I knew what the meeting was going to be about. The leadership team at the last church I served at had been meeting the night before, and they're praying and talking through whether or not they were going to close down the multi-site campus that I've been the pastor of for the past 6 years. And I knew that barring a miracle from God, that I was going to walk into this meeting with a job, and I was going to walk out of this meeting without one. That morning was a really surreal one. I'd stupidly arranged to have a meeting with someone from the community who I'm sure was really pleased that I was sitting at the table in this coffee shop, and I was present, but I wasn't really present. The meeting finished up, and this coffee shop was located a block or two away from this park that overlooked the elementary school where our church met. And so I put my bag in my car, I walked down the block, and I sat in this park bench that overlooked the school. It was recess, and I watched some of these kids playing on the playground across the street, and I thought about some of our kids from our church that I'd watched play on that playground across the street. I thought about events that we'd held there. I thought about that building. I thought about the times when it was nighttime and, like, just at some crazy, weird prompting from God, I would, like, drive to the building and I'd walk around the building by myself and pray for it and also simultaneously fear that someone from the city was going to be like, sir, you're trespassing and arrest me or move me away, you know. I'd laid hands on this building to pray for the ministry that was going to happen inside of it. I remember driving up to this building as the highlight of my week. I remember the days when I drove up to this building dreading the conversation that was going to happen outside or the message I was going to have to preach. I remember standing in the parking lot and saying to my best friend, Emily, as I walked in as this newly minted 22-year-old worship pastor on the first day our church launched, going, Emily, if I can just throw up, I feel like I'll be able to make it through the end of this day, okay? And I walked into this meeting this afternoon. D-Day was here, and the meeting went as I expected. You know, it left without a job. And there was this period of time between 3 and 6 p.m. that day where I don't really remember anything about what I did. I may have tried to work out at the gym. I may have just randomly driven around Northwest Indiana. But what I do remember is that that period ended with me sitting and then eventually lying down on the couch in our living room, asking a very singular question, now what? I remember the emotions that went through my heart that day. I remember the emotion of feeling like a failure, feeling like I'd messed it up. Here I had this simple thing to do. I had this task at hand, and I didn't accomplish it. All my life, I'd been an achiever, I've been an all-A student, I was a Dean's List person, and finally, at the tender age of 28, I'd encountered the challenge that I was not able to succeed against. I remember sitting on our couch and feeling anxiety and fear. Anxiety over the sense that, hey, I knew a week from now, I was not just going to have to process through this myself, I was going to have to lead people at our church to process through this decision, and I wasn't really looking forward to that. I remembered feeling fear, knowing that the severance package that was very generous and equipped me well now was going to run out before I knew it. And I knew that we'd have to figure out something as a family. I remember the feeling of loss, the loss of this job, but also just the loss of knowing that most likely, however this saga unfolded, that was probably going to end up with me leaving friends and people who felt like my family. I remember feeling frustration. The entire year, I poured myself into every hard conversation, into every follow-up phone call, into every leadership event, into every message, into everything I knew how, and it still wasn't enough. And somehow, despite feeling all those feelings, I also felt no feeling at all. I felt numb. I couldn't believe that this is where my life had come and that this is where I was sitting right now. I don't think that I'm that unique. I think that every single person in this room at some point or another is going to ask that question. Now what? Some of us in this room have asked this question with some stuff in our lives that's a 9 or 10 on the emotional Richter scale. I'm coping with abuse. I'm coping with a childhood of neglect. I'm dealing with mental illness. I'm dealing with grief over the loss of a loved one who matters more than I could imagine to me. Some of us, we are on the opposite end of the spectrum, and we ask, now what? But we more yell it as our TV screen as we watch, you know, the Seminoles drop another game at home or do something as trivial as that. For most of us in this room, it probably lies between those two extremes. Maybe you, like me, have lost a job. Maybe you're seeing a season of your life end without achieving what you'd hoped. Maybe another year has passed by and, you know, that man or that woman still hasn't walked into your life. You know, maybe you're grieving a financial loss. Maybe you're grieving graduating from college, and I have no idea what you're going to do. We've all asked this question. And over the next 5 weeks as a church, we want to take a journey to see what does God have to say about this question. And what I love about this series is that over the course of the next 5 weeks, we're going to look at five stories of five ordinary, average people just like you, just like me, people who hurt like you and hurt like me, people who struggle like you and struggle like me. And we're going to see, what does God have to say to us when we ask this question, now what? Today, we're going to look at the story of a guy named David. And David has a story that many of you are probably familiar with to some degree. We first meet David in a book, an ancient document in the Bible called 1 Samuel. In chapter 16, David is approached by a man named Samuel, and he is anointed the next king of Israel around 1000 BC or so. Now, this is a really big problem because Israel already had a king. His name was Saul. And God had decided that Saul was just continually disobeying and disregarding him. And God had decided not just that Israel needed a new king, but God decided that Israel needed a regime change. And that's where David enters the picture. And David's anointed king, and no one quite really understands how this is going to transpire because, again, there's already a king, and David is not from this guy's family, and you know, God didn't give him some military order to somehow seize the throne by force. In the very next chapter of David's story, David goes to a battlefield. He's sent by his dad to bring some provisions to his brothers and to hear news about how this war is going. And as David's there, he sees this massive giant, a guy named Goliath from Gath, who walks out, challenges Israel, Israel's God, and Israel's army. And as David looks around and he sees no one else really willing to step up and do anything about it, he decides, well, I can help. And with a stone and a sling, David slays Goliath the giant. Overnight, David became an international superstar. He went from a little shepherd boy at 16 to like international celebrity. They would actually write a folk song almost overnight about David's life. They would say that Saul had killed his thousands, but David had slain his 10,000s. Saul would grow increasingly insecure. He saw the rising star that David was. He saw the trouble on the horizon. And so Saul tried to control David. He invited him to live in the palace. Saul decided he would give one of his daughters in marriage to David if David could single-handedly take down a small Philistine army, thinking, surely, this is going to be a suicide mission. No one is going to make it out of this alive. And yet, to Saul's and everyone else's surprise, David did. David's fame grew and grew and grew, and Saul became more and more and more insecure. And then Saul one day told his closest officers and palace guard that he was going to kill David. Saul knew he couldn't announce this to the kingdom. He couldn't declare David a fugitive to everyone because surely it would invite a coup. He was so popular and well-respected. But Saul was making it his personal mission to end David's life. And overnight, David, the international celebrity, now became a fugitive, on the run from his home, from everything he knew. And this is where we pick up the story. In 1 Samuel chapter 21, we read this. David went to Nob. Nob was a priestly community just outside of Jerusalem. It was sort of like a less opulent version of Vatican City, if you want to think about it that way. This is where like religious people live, you know, where clergy and stuff like that lived. So David went to Nob to Ahimelech, the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he met him. He knew who David was. He's like, whoa, yeah, David, you're here? And he asked, why are you alone? Why is no one with you? David answered Ahimelech the priest, the king sent me on a mission, lie, and said to me, no one is to know anything about the mission I am sending you on, also a lie. As for my men, what men, lie, I have told them to meet me at a certain place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread, whatever you can find. But the priest answered David, I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here. So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there except the bread of the presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread the day it was taken away. In the temple, commonly, they would offer like a grain offering, like bread to God, essentially. And what would happen is the priest would make this bread in the morning, they'd present it to God as an offering, and then when the day was over, they would take that and that would become like their meal, essentially, to eat. And so Ahimelech apparently saw David was in such a bad state, he decided, hey, this really goes against the rules, but you look like you need some help right now. And so here you go. I want to be able to help you out. So David finishes eating. He gets these provisions. And then David has another question for Ahimelech. Ahimelech, don't you have a spear or a sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any other weapon because the king's mission was urgent. Again, a lie. The priest replied, well, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, who you killed in the Valley of Elah is here. It is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. That's like the priestly garment. If you want it, take it. There is no sword here but that one. David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. Now, do not skimp past this detail. How do you think David would have felt holding that sword? Right, this is a sword that not too long ago, David himself took off of the body of Goliath the Philistine as he celebrated the high point of his life, and he presented it to King Saul in this incredible act of nobility, of bravery, of courage. And as David holds this sword in his hand, he is not just holding a sword, he is holding a memory of what his life once was. This is salt in the wound. This is you miscarrying and then a couple weeks later finding that ultrasound picture among all your things as you're looking for your keys or something one day. This is you standing up in a wedding or attending that reception and trying on the outside to be happy for what's going on in your friend or your family member's life. But on the inside, you're just writhing away because you wish that was you. This is you scrolling through your Facebook or your Instagram feed and you seeing that happy family with the happy life and everything perfect and put together and being reminded of how not happy and not put together and totally imperfect your life is. This is a visual reminder of now what? So David leaves the temple. And that day, David fled from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. Okay, Gath is one of the cities in Philistia. Okay, this is like David's arch rival. This is like Jimbo Fisher looking for sanctuary in Gainesville. Okay, this is Tanya Harding asking for money from Nancy Kerrigan or something. Yeah, we can go old school with that. Okay, these are things that should not be together. Okay, David, by him going to the king to do anything other than kill King Achish, is pretty much traitorous. But David's in a tough place. So he flees. And the servants of Achish, the king, said to him, isn't this David, the king of the land? Like, his fame has already traveled. People already know who this guy is. His reputation precedes him. Isn't he the one they sing about in their song and their dances? Saul has killed his thousands and David his tens of thousands. David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, king of Gath, because he needs something from him. He needs him both not to kill him and to grant him sanctuary. So David pretended to be insane in their presence. While he was in their hands, he acted like a madman, making marks on the doors of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Do you think this was a high point for David? Do you think that he enjoyed having to fake insanity so he could somehow win the support of this rival king? Apparently, David won enough support from Achish that he was allowed to live in the land, but Achish, because he was insane and a madman, wouldn't let him live in the city. He had to live in a cave outside of the city. We discover that David's family had to move in with him because they couldn't stay at home. Saul knew they were there, right? Surely they would be slaughtered and killed, or they would be held as hostage to somehow bring David out of hiding. Okay, it just can't get worse for David. Like, keeps getting lower and lower and lower. My life's a wreck. I'm living a lie. Now my family's life is a wreck, and it's because of me. And that's where another detail comes into play. We discover that when David was with Ahimelech, the priest, that there was another man in the temple that day, a guy named Doeg the Edomite. And Doeg was like a mercenary that was hired by Saul. He was given this title of chief shepherd, but it seems that he was more really there to be a spy. The Doeg would look around, and he would basically keep his ear to the ground and let King Saul know about anything that was happening that he thought he needed to know about. And of course, when Doeg sees David in the temple that day, and especially when he sees him getting rations and food and supplies and a weapon from the priest, Doeg reported that to Saul. So Saul calls for Ahimelech to come in. They have a conversation. It goes about as poorly as you'd expect. And at the end of this conversation, here's what Saul says. The king said, "You will surely die, Ahimelech, you and your whole family." And the king then ordered Doeg, "You turn and strike down the priest." So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. He killed 85 innocent priests. But that wasn't enough. He put to the sword Nob, the entire town of the priests with its men and women, its children and infants, its cattle, donkeys, and sheep. He tore this town down. There was not a soul left in sight. Complete, utter destruction. But one son of Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled to join David. He told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, "That day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he would be sure to tell Saul, 'I am responsible for the death of your family.'" Well, that's an upper. That feels really good, doesn't it? You're David, you're sitting here, your life stinks. And now what do you find out? You find out that, oh, great, now I'm responsible for the death of many more innocent people. All right, that day I told a little white lie. Maybe Ahimelech would have helped me anyway. I don't really know. I was just trying to get his assistance. Maybe he would have helped me anyway if I told him the truth. I don't know, but at least he would have known what he was getting into. I saw Doeg there. I knew he was going to be trouble. I knew I shouldn't leave without taking care of him. I knew I should have captured him or maybe killed him. I could have at least told the other priests and people in this city, "Hey, just so you know, this guy's here. You might want to get your escape plan ready. You know, you might want to buy your evacuation pack and all this stuff because things aren't looking very good." But because I was scared, because I was angry, or because I was flustered, or whatever David's reason was, I didn't. And yeah, I wasn't the one that held the sword. Yeah, this is Saul's fault. But you know what? If I'm really honest with myself, I'm going to go to sleep knowing that there's at least this little part of me that feels kind of culpable. Now, I want to hit the pause button here for a second. David's now what story probably correlates in some ways with ours. We've all felt low. We've all felt in a pit like David does, or in David's case, he literally was. But I think we can extract four truths from David's story about now what that we're actually going to return to throughout the course of this series. Today, I want to look at each of these briefly, and I want to encourage you today to think about how these correspond to my life. And specifically, as we leave today, I don't want you to just leave with more information. I want you to leave with a little bit of a transformation. Because I think in each of these four things is contained a next step. And my bet is, if you're like me, and when you're living in the now what situation, that we don't always, we just feel helpless. We feel hopeless. We feel caught. We feel trapped. And one of the things that now what does is it just makes us stagnant. It makes us like, you know, fish in a barrel. Like we can't go anywhere. And I think that actually these truths all propel us to do something or propel us to go somewhere. It may not be easy. It may not be simple. It's not something you can probably do overnight. But it's something that I think God wants us to do if we truly want to be healthy, whole, changed. Let me share these four truths with you. Truth number one. Now what is a time to grieve what is lost? Psalm 52 is a prayer or a song or a poem written by David. And if you open up your Bible to Psalm 52, you're going to see the very first words in that psalm are something to the effect of, this is a psalm for Doeg the Edomite. Okay, so basically, David is writing this in response to the news he's just gotten about Doeg in the story. And here's what David says. It says, "You love evil rather than good, falsehood rather than speaking the truth. You love every harmful word, you deceitful tongue. Surely God will bring you down to everlasting ruin. He will snatch you up and pluck you from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous will see and fear. They will laugh at you, saying, 'Here now is the man who did not make God his stronghold, but trusted in his great wealth and grew strong by destroying others.'" Whew, right? Like that is a mouthful. This is part of David's grieving process. He's mad. He's angry. He feels hurt. He feels betrayed. And what does he do? He expresses it. He grieves it. He holds in his hands his life. He says, you know what? Things are not going to turn out the way I hoped that they would. And he doesn't just try and stuff it down. He actually does something with it. Oftentimes, I think we get this notion that a mature relationship with God somehow looks like me suppressing my feelings, never really getting too high and never really getting too low and never really letting anything shake us. I think that David's story reveals to us that actually a mature relationship with God looks like us having the courage to express to God what we feel, what we think, the revenge we wish we could take, the anger that we're wrestling with, the sadness that we wrestle with. Because oftentimes what happens is when we encounter a now what circumstance, we just hang on to it. We suppress it. And what happens is we throw it in our backpack. And we bring that ungrieved loss with us into every relationship we go to, every workplace we find ourselves in, every city we move to, every family event we gather at. Okay, we just bring it everywhere with us. And it's possible that for some of us in this room, you're 49 and you're living out the 19-year-old baggage that you carried from a season or two ago in your life because you never really did anything with it. Don't keep carrying grief in your backpack. Right? Don't allow your grief to be a wedge between others and you and God and you. It's okay to grieve what is lost. And if you need permission today to do that, receive it. As much as I'm able to speak into your life, I want to give that to you because that is part of how we heal and how we recover from now what. Truth number two is now what is a really poor indicator of God's favor on you. If you keep reading in David's story, here's what you're going to find, is David never once in this story loses the favor of God. God is not dissatisfied with what David did. In fact, it's because David was trying to do the right thing, he found himself in a now what, which is honestly kind of how life works sometimes, isn't it? Right? It's not David's fault that God chose him to become the next king. It's not David's fault he stepped up to courageously slay Goliath when no one else would. It's not David's fault that Saul got jealous and led him to flee. Right? It's not David's fault, ultimately, that a whole community was destroyed because of one man's insecurity and jealousy and envy. If you keep reading David's story, you're going to see the wrongs put right in his life again. And David's not perfect. He's going to mess it up. But the God of the universe would eventually label David a man after his own heart. David was doing something right. On the whole, David did a pretty good job in this relationship with God thing, apparently. And yet what's so true is when I'm mired in the now what circumstance, I somehow think that that is God's indictment on me. That if I hadn't, if I didn't, if I could, I would have, I should have, then maybe this wouldn't be happening to me. And I just got to let you know, this is a really bad way to figure out that question. A friend of mine a few years ago told me about a story. He's a pastor. And after service, this teenage daughter walked up to him with her mom. And she was talking about something that happened. Her boyfriend had broken up with her this week. And she was like saying, man, does God listen to prayers? And why would he let this happen to me? And da, 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 da. And she's like, just carrying on and on and on. She walked away. It was this kind of sad conversation. And the mom lingered behind for about 5 or 10 seconds and said, I know my daughter may not believe in the power of prayer, but I sure do. I've been praying for that relationship to end for a while now, okay? And I think sometimes the same thing happens in our life. If you've ever had a circumstance in your life where when it happened, you're like, man, this sucks. And then you get a couple weeks or a couple months or maybe a couple years, and you look back and you can actually see, man, that I would never want to hit the replay button on that segment of my life ever again. But boy, am I glad it happened. Boy, am I glad for what I saw it shape me into. Boy, am I glad for things God accomplished that season. You get this truth, right? That sometimes in our lives, I interpret my current events as a signal of God's displeasure for me, and that is the worst possible time for me to evaluate that. God's thinking long game. He's looking at his calendar, not at his watch. We should be too. Third truth, and this is a hard one. Now what is an opportunity to take responsibility for brokenness? One of the things that now what should provoke us to do is ask a very simple question, which is, hey, do I own any of this? Do I own any of this? Do I have anything that's my fault? And there's some now what, your answer might be no, okay? Some now what's are entirely not of your own making. Some of you in this room, you're walking through abuse, you're walking through illness, you're walking through stuff that you did nothing to deserve, okay? So the answer could very well be no. But I think it's good for us to step back when we encounter a now what and at least ask the question. Because oftentimes when I experience a now what in my life, even if it's the tiniest little sliver of responsibility, I know that I've got a piece of the pie that I need to own, that I need to handle, that I need to fix if I can or learn from if I can't. David did this in this story. And 1 Samuel 22, David said to Abiathar, this is the son of Ahimelech, the priest who was killed. That day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he would be sure to tell Saul, I am responsible for the death of your whole family. Stay with me. Don't be afraid. The man who wants to kill you is trying to kill me too. You are safe with me, right? What does David do? He says, you know what? I may not be at fault, but I know I own a piece of this. And Abiathar, I got to own it, man. And I wish I could go back and fix it, but at the very least moving forward, I can offer all I can do to try and help you. try and make things right with you. This is painful. This is incredibly healthy. But because it's painful, it's incredibly hard to do. A couple weeks ago, I was cleaning out my work bag that I carry with me everywhere when I go out to work at a coffee shop or something like that. It's kind of like, you know, some of you, women who have a purse, it's like, oh, wow, there's my old VCRs in there. So, like you have all this kind of crazy stuff in there. And my bag was getting to that point where I needed to sort through it so I could fit more junk in it that I didn't need. And I was going through my bag, and I came across this old brown moleskin notebook. And first off, I opened it because I was like, oh, maybe it's got blank pages in it. I could still use it. Yeah, I'm flipping through, and it had none. I flipped through, and I got to the back cover. And on the very final page of this notebook, I'd made a list of all the stuff that I wish I could go back and change about the church that I pastored that closed, about all the stuff that I wish I would have been doing differently, all the stuff that I learned, all the stuff that, man, if I could have a redo on that, I would have played it way differently next time. And I remember sitting at the Starbucks a couple miles from my house and could take you to the table where I was. I remember just feeling like an idiot as I'm scrawling these 6 or 7 sentences on this sheet of paper. I had names attached to some of them. I had very vividly in my mind conversations and things that I did not do well with. I was convicted about some of the stuff that I haven't done. I nodded my head in agreement at some of the stuff I had and went, yeah, that's right. For some of us in this room, that idea of taking responsibility for brokenness, it feels impossible to do. It feels outrageous for someone to ask you. And again, maybe the answer is no, right? Maybe the answer is, hey, I don't have culpability here. But I want to encourage you, man, when you encounter a now what, that's an off-ramp for us to hit the pause button and think about our lives and think about, man, God, are you trying to grab my attention here? Last thing. Now what is an invitation to allow God to use crisis to bring transformation? Isn't it true that in your life, you never stop and think about your life when things are going great? In fact, it's now what that reveals that to me. Like, it's now what? It's when I'm living in the depths of the valley that I just look back and go, man, I did not understand how great I had it. I was cruising through life. I thought this was normal. And now I'm in the pit and I'm looking back at that and thinking, man, you know, I wish I could go back and help me see. Don't take this for granted. Oftentimes, C.S. Lewis writes, God uses pain as a megaphone to rouse our deaf world. Because here's the truth, is oftentimes in my life, until it hurts, I'm not going to examine it. And there's an old leadership axiom that says, people won't move until the pain of change is less than the pain of staying the same. David was committed to moving forward and to seeing God work transformation in his life in the midst of this crisis. See, that's what he writes on Psalm 34. This is a psalm that has the heading of, it was after he appeared before the king of Gath, Achish. This was right after David pretended to be an insane person to gain sanctuary into his arch rival's territory. And David writes, taste and see that the Lord is good. Doesn't feel like it. Those don't feel like the words I would write in that season of my life. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears them. He delivers them from all their troubles. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted. He saves those who are crushed in spirit. The righteous person may have many troubles. The Lord delivers them from them all. He protects all of his bones, and not one of them will be broken. Evil will slay the wicked. The foes of the righteous will be condemned. The Lord will rescue his servants, and no one who takes refuge in him will be condemned. When I encounter now what in my life, my tendency is I want to stray. I want to sit. I want to wallow. I want to let whatever's happening be a thing that just defines me. I don't want to go anywhere. David embodies for us this idea that when we encounter now what, we shouldn't stray. Instead, we should seek. And if we will commit ourselves to saying, God, it sucks. I hate this. I hate this situation. Maybe I hate this person. Maybe, God, right now, I'm kind of hating you, actually. But God, I'm committed to seeking whatever it is you want me to find right now. Like, I'm just going to do that. That opens up the door wide open for transformation. You see, now what? It presents us this opportunity. It can be a catalyst for growth with God, or it can be a chasm that separates us from him. But oftentimes, the scary thing is, we decide. We decide which it's going to be. We decide if now what will be something that propels us into something better, or if now what becomes something that causes us to shrink up and become bitter. And the scariest part about that is I decide, and you decide. Now what is not an easy place to be. I don't pretend to think that anything that we just talked about was like, oh, all better now. Thank you so much. But Crossbridge, why pray for us? Why I'm praying like a madman for? Why I know some other people from across our church are praying like crazy for? So we would choose to be a community that seeks instead of strays. That we would have the courage to confront our now what and extract from it every bit of what God desires for us to experience. Let me pray for us to experience that right now. Father in heaven, God, I pray for those of us in this room who are facing a pretty serious now what. God, for the situations where, like that video earlier, we just feel like our life is scattered like a million Legos on the floor. I pray you would put us back together again. I pray that we would commit ourselves to seeking you. I pray, God, that we would grieve what is lost. God, I pray that we would be reminded in a tangible way this week that your silence does not equate to absence, and it certainly does not equate to you not caring for us. God, I pray that we would own what you've given us to own, and God, that we would rely on you for what we can't. God, give us your grace to walk through challenge, to walk through difficulty, to walk through now what. We pray this in the powerful name of Jesus.